Happy Hanukkah to everyone. Those of you who are on my time zone, I appreciate you pushing off your latkes or your sufganiyot for a little bit to come to class. But don't worry, you can have them afterwards. Mine are already waiting for me. So we are in the last class of our series. And what we're going to see is kind of a depressing class to end with. But on the other hand, it's kind of necessary because what we're going to be talking about is what we've been talking about for the last at least two classes is this messianic yearning, right? We've had these crises. We've had these troubles, the exile from Spain. We're going to see there are more troubles, always troubles in Jewish history, unfortunately. And where does all of this yearning go, right? We talked about it in Kabbalah. We talked about it in Dona Gracia and the Smicha controversy. Please mute yourselves or maybe Maxine mute everybody. Thank you. But here we're going to see that this messianic yearning goes into a very strange and kind of a crazy phenomenon, which is this wildfire spreading of a belief in a false messiah. False messiahs have been throughout Jewish history, but usually they're very localized, right? And this is, as Gershon Shalom puts it, and we're going to be talking about him quite a bit, this is the largest messianic movement since Bar Kokhba, or you could say since Jesus, right? And it really spreads all over the world. It happens to be, because we're already in the 17th century, rather well documented, lots of pictures, lots of letters, right? This is also the time where we have a printing press, right? So a lot of things are known about it, and yet many things are still unknown. We're going to try to sketch out the story. And then it's just over. And it's kind of buried in Jewish history. And there are actually some people who may have heard the name Shabtai Tzvi, but don't know who it refers to or have never even heard of it. It's not something that's really like pointed out as the pride of place in Jewish history. Understandably, we will see why. But it had an enormous impact at the time. Okay. What the picture that you're looking at here, we have a lot of pictures. This one was kind of stolen from Beit HaTfutzot, as you can see on the bottom. We have a lot of pictures, mostly fictitious. A couple of them perhaps real, of this whole story of Shabtai Tzvi and his armies and his pomp and his circumstance and how people prepared for him. So we're going to see a couple of those pictures as we go along. And again, these are pictures, woodcuts that spread like wildfire throughout the Jewish world, as well as, which is really kind of crazy, the Christian world. Christians are also fascinated by this. Muslims are also fascinated by this. So let's go back to our favorite thing, which is timeline, of course. There are certain things that obviously we could put many things in here. What I wanted to emphasize were a few different things. First of all, the crises of this time period. So we've already spent quite some time talking about the expulsion from Spain. And how that was such an enormous crisis, certainly for Sephardic Jews, but in general around the world. We're going to come to another very significant crisis in the 17th century in a minute. So those are some things to point out. We also want to notice the Ottoman Empire, right? The Ottoman conquest, we've already talked about that, but it's important to understand because as we're going to see, Shabtai Tzvi travels into various places around the Ottoman Empire. And the fact that you have this very vast area that's all under one ruler means you can travel easily. It means news can travel easily. It means you have one person who's in charge of all these places and can do what he likes with people who he doesn't like. Right. So the Ottoman Empire, that's a very big part of the story. Okay. And the other thing that I put in here is the Ari, right? Rav Yitzchak Luria, the years that he's in Tzfat, the last 2.5 years of his life, because as we're going to see, Lurianic Kabbalah plays very much a part in this story. So it's kind of bringing together a lot of the last few classes, but with some new things as well. Okay. The other major crisis that's happening in this time period, 1648, terrible, terrible massacres, Cossack rebellion in Poland, Lithuania, and the Ukraine, what's known in Hebrew as Gzerot Tachvetat, right, after the Hebrew years, 1648 and 1649. very, very terrible stories and part of this whole sense of crisis and of tragedy, right? But let's look back at our Shabtai Tzvi timeline for a moment. Okay, Shabtai Tzvi is born in 1626 in a Turkish town called Izmir. Its ancient name is Smyrna. You hear the two names are kind of used interchangeably. Okay, meanwhile, almost 20 years later, almost 20 years younger than him, we have the other very significant personality in the story, and that's Natan Ashkenazi. He's born as Natan Ashkenazi, but he becomes known as Natan of Aza, Natan HaAzati, Nathan of Gaza. He's born in Jerusalem. Okay, we're going to see another player in the story is Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz, and he's from Morocco, but he comes to Jerusalem and he opens a yeshiva. Okay, and then we have the kind of the playing out of the Shabtai Tzvi story, which happens over a really very short period of time. All right, Shabtai Tzvi already starts talking in the late 1640s, early 1650s about him being the Messiah, but it doesn't really become important in the world until 1665. Okay, and then we have a lot of drama that happens in 1665, in 1666, coming to a head in September of 1666, where, spoiler alert here, Shabtai Tzvi does not become the Messiah, but he converts to Islam. Okay, so it all happens in a very, very short period of time, a little more than a year. Shabtai Tzvi lives another 10 years after that. Okay, Natan HaAzati lives another 14 years after that. And then we're going to finish up our story with the story of an iconic synagogue in Jerusalem, the Horma Synagogue. How is it connected? We'll have to wait and see. Okay, so that's our timeline. Let's understand a little bit of these background stories. Okay, so this bizarre phenomenon, right? Why does this false Messiah catch on more than any of the others, right? Last time we talked about Shlomo Molcho, we talked about David HaRuveni. They catch on, but not in the same way. This is almost a global in the sense of the Jewish world, right? It's not happening in America, right? But it's a global phenomenon. And there are a lot of different ways to explain it. So one way of explaining it is we are in the time period of what's called in Hebrew the Chevlei Mashiach, right? The birth pangs of the Messiah. And this is a very popular idea in Jewish philosophy that when terrible things happen, right, it's a good way to kind of understand the bigger picture. If terrible things are happening, it must be that Mashiach is on the way. We're suffering so much. God is bringing the suffering only because he's then going to bring the Mashiach. And we saw this with the story of the expulsion from Spain. And we see it with this story that we have over here. This is a very nice answer, but as Gershon Scholem points out, the appeal of Shabtai Tzvi was not limited to the places where Jews were persecuted. Even in places, and in fact, especially in places where Jews were doing well, for example, Amsterdam, for example, Hamburg, Shabtai Tzvi is just as popular, maybe even more popular. So the tragedy and the Chevlei Mashiach cannot be the only answer, right? But we do have this terrible story, 1648, 1649, this Cossack rebellion, terrible situation, because what happens is, well, the Cossacks murder a lot of people, but they particularly have it in for the Jews, because the Jews are in a very bad situation. Jews have come to Poland and Lithuania when the countries are kind of just opening up, right? We talked about them coming after the expulsion from Spain, but they've been there before, and they serve a very significant economic role. They are the middleman between the wealthy Polish and Lithuanian landowners, who often don't live anywhere near their land holdings, and the peasants who are working that land. And the Jews have the very thankless but lucrative job of collecting all the taxes, of running the estate. So when the Cossacks come and it's this popular revolt, who are you going to turn against? Who are these bloodsuckers who are taking all your money all the time? Clearly, it's the Jews, right? And they just rampage through the Jewish communities. And we have this terrible, terrible account. It's an eyewitness account from 1653. This is a guy named Natan Netta Hanover. And he writes a book called Yevein HaMitzula, The Abyss of Despair. And he's an eyewitness to what happens in his town. Plus, he hears from a lot of other people. Terrible stories. Does he exaggerate? Does he exaggerate the numbers? Probably. Does he exaggerate the atrocities? I'm not so sure. But in any case, this is the perception that this is something awful, right? And here's just a little bit of it. I edited out the more horrific parts. Many communities beyond the Dnieper, close to the battlefield, such as, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce all of these, and their neighbors who were unable to escape perished for the sanctification of his name, right? And there's a lot of parallel that the Yevein HaMetzulah does to the Crusader Chronicles, right? Just like Jews in the Crusades died al Kiddush Hashem, so too here. These persons died cruel and bitter deaths. Some were skinned alive and their flesh was thrown to the dog. Some had their hands and limbs chopped off, their bodies thrown on the highway only to be trampled by wagon, then crushed by horses. Some had wounds inflicted upon them and thrown on the street to die a slow death. They writhed in their blood till they breathed their last. Others were buried alive. There was no cruel device of murder in the whole world that was not perpetrated by the enemies, right? Terrible, terrible things. Originally, 100 years ago, Jewish historians said 100,000, 200,000 Jews were murdered. Now we think it's closer to 20,000, but that doesn't make it less terrible. And this was something that was remembered for a very long time. We had special El Malei Rachamim prayers that mentioned the victims of Tach V'Tat, and that's what this is on the right here. This is actually a handwritten list of some of the victims, presumably from a specific town, right? This is an El Malei Rachamim to remember these Harugim al Kiddush Hashem, right? These guys who were murdered for the sanctification of God's name. So this is a very, very terrible event, and perhaps is one of the catalysts for our story, right? What are other catalysts? Perhaps there's socioeconomic stuff going on. But again, what we see is that the rich as well as the poor are jumping on the Shabtai Tzvi bandwagon. It's not really only the poor, only the rich, right? It's not a dividing along socioeconomic lines. So there might be a little of that in certain communities, but it can't be the only reason. Okay. We also have this idea that, remember all our messianic hopes, right? Remember last class, we talked about Shlomo Malchum, we talked about David HaRuveni, and there are all these false messiahs who are coming along. There's a lot of messianic fervor that's floating around in the world, not only with the Jews, by the way, right? The Christians also, this showdown between the Christians and the Muslims. There are particular dates that people think are significant. The Jews believe that 1648 is a date for the Messiah. Obviously, that is belied by these terrible massacres, but 1648, based on a passage from the Zohar. The Christians believe that 1666, based on a passage from the Book of Revelations, 1666 is going to be the year. And in fact, the picture you have here on the left is actually Shlomo Molcho's signature, so I brought him in. But we also have these 17th century stories, not only 16th century. Menashe ben Yisrael, very interesting character for a different class. He is a Jew who is writing letters from the Netherlands. He's writing to Oliver Cromwell, right? We have this new rulership, this new leadership in England. The Jews had been expelled from England centuries before. Menashe ben Yisrael writes a letter to Oliver Cromwell saying it's time to let the Jews back in. And in the letter, he enumerates all sorts of good reasons why the Jews should be let back in. But one of them, the opinions of many Christians and mine do concur herein, that we both believe the restoring time of our nation into their native country is very near at hand. Mashiach is coming, right? Menashe ben Yisrael tells us, and we have a lot of letters and a lot of witnesses, testimony that talks about this. So messianic expectations, terrible tragedies, perhaps some socioeconomic issues. But the real reason is, at least the real reason, as is given by Gershon Scholem, we're going to see something different. But first, let's understand a little bit of who Gershon Scholem is. So Rabbi Kalman mentioned this quote, I don't know, last time, 2 times ago. It's a very famous quote attributed to Professor Shaul Lieberman, professor of Talmud, great scholar in the Talmud and the Tosefta. And when Gershon Scholem came to America, supposedly, Professor Lieberman introduced him as the scholar of the Kabbalah, right? And he says superstition or mysticism is nonsense, but the study of superstition is scholarship, right? It's a great quote, perhaps apocryphal, but it points out the fact that Gershom Scholem is the first person to engage in an academic study of Jewish mysticism. There have always been Kabbalists and mystics in the Jewish tradition, but they've been mystics on a religious level, on on a spiritual level, even practical Kabbalah, but an academic study ever since the beginnings of Jewish academic study, right? Wissenschaft in the 19th century. Scholars looked at this stuff and they said, really? This is what you're going to study, right? Gershom Scholem tells a story about how he heard that somebody had a great collection of Kabbalistic books, and he goes to him and he asks him, you know, does he study them? And the guy says to him, this trash, I would never read this, right? So that this very rationalist approach to mysticism, and Gershom Scholem takes a different look. So who is he? He's just interesting to talk about in and of himself. He was a fascinating character, right? He was born in 1897 in Berlin, to a very, very assimilated Jewish family. If you're interested in him, he wrote a fascinating autobiography called From Berlin to Jerusalem. Very short and easy to read. He was a really interesting person. He's born to this very assimilated family. And in his autobiography, he writes about, you know, he wants to give examples of how assimilated they are. He says, we would light the Shabbat candles and leave them on the table, and then we would light our cigars from the Shabbat candles, right? So that's just to give you a little, and he talks about having his bread and his matzah on the table at Pesach, right? Very, very assimilated family. But he, early on, and the classic German Jewish, right? Middle class, very much part of the German world, but he very early on kind of sees the emptiness of that world, and he's drawn both to Judaism and, perhaps more significantly for him anyway, to Zionism. Okay, and he starts to study. He doesn't stay observant. He's not a religious person, but he's fascinated by Jewish texts and particularly by Kabbalah. And already early on, he's reading books that nobody but Kabbalists have been reading, and he's reading them and he's writing academic works on them. In 1923, he realizes there's no future for the Jews in Germany. Very early on, by the way, he realizes that. He leaves. He comes to the land of Israel. He's got to make a living. 1923, you know, he's trained as a Kabbalistic academic scholar. Where is he making a living exactly? Right? Hebrew University is just beginning. He's going to become the first professor ever of Jewish mysticism in Hebrew University, but as of yet, there's no jobs. So what does he do? He moves to Rehavia, where all the scholars and the academics and the archaeologists live. He makes friends with someone named Hugo Bergmann, who runs the National Library, right? There's already a National Library. And Hugo Bergmann says, okay, you know, you need a job. You can be the librarian in the National Library. You can catalog the books. And Gershom Scholem, his whole life, is fascinated by books. He's a real book collector. And he says, okay, that's great. Wonderful. What are you going to pay me? And he says, well, I don't really have a budget to pay you, but we have something in the library. We call it Kupat HaShnoririm, the box that when the visitors from America come, we schnorr, we ask them for a little money. Whatever goes into Kupat HaShnoririm, that's yours. That'll be your salary. So from that very humble beginning, he rises to become a professor and to become the real expert on Kabbalah for many years, right? And the whole next generation of academic scholars of Jewish mysticism is all trained by him, right? It all comes from him. And like with anything in academia today, there's pushback against his ideas, but he really lays the foundation. And he's also an avid book collector. He actually makes himself what he calls a negative card catalog, meaning all the books he doesn't have and he wants, right? And he calls it Alu L'Shalom. Now, he has all kinds of fascinating ideas about Jewish mysticism and its development over the years. And he was particularly fascinated by Shabtai Tzvi. And this book that he wrote, this enormous magisterial book about Shabtai Tzvi, was considered for many, many decades to be the book. And today, there are scholars who are suggesting other things or expanding what he said. But still, it is still the book on the subject of Shabtai Tzvi. And if you're fascinated by this story, this is what you should get. And his theory is what we're going to be talking about, not only, but one of the things we're going to be talking about today. So what he says is that the reason that Shabtai Tzvi becomes so incredibly successful is all those other reasons that we said before, but even more than that, Lurianic Kabbalah. Right. Remember, two times ago, we talked about Rav Yitzchak Luria, and he comes to the Ari and he comes to Tzfat. Right. This is the grave of the Ari. So this is just to give us a little feeling of the Ari. He comes to Tzfat And he's a brilliant Kabbalist, but he doesn't just study the old books, but he comes up with new ideas, right? And those ideas are connected to exile and redemption, right? The Shechina is in exile. They are connected to fixing, right? Tikkun, how can we bring the Shechina out of exile? They're connected to our very practical, when we do the mitzvot, we are raising up these broken pieces, these broken vessels, these shells, and taking the light out of the klipot, out of the shells, and restoring it to where it belongs. And there's also very much a palpable feeling of messianic expectation, right? The Ari and his students believe the Messiah is on the way any moment now. It's imminent. It's happening. And we are the ones who are going to bring it closer. And Gershom Scholem talks about how by the 1630s, right, the Ari comes up with these ideas in the 1560s. By the 1630s, partly because of the advent of the printing press, right, and books being passed on faster than they had been before, these ideas have permeated throughout the Jewish world, not just in the land of Israel, not just in the Ottoman Empire, but in Europe as well. And this creates a very, very fertile ground for the things that Shabtai Tzvi and Natan of Aza are going to say, right? And one of the things that he says, which I think is a brilliant idea, he talks about, you know, we talk about political liberation and there's a lot of Jewish pride and the Jews are going to return to their land. He says, no, no, that's just the external kind of the dressing of cosmic liberation, right? We're talking about redeeming the Shekhinah. That's the real story, the grand drama. If the Jews along the way are redeemed from their servitude among the nations, that's a piece of the story. But the grand story is God being redeemed. And this is what explains how it succeeds on such a global scale, that people know these ideas and they say, of course, this is what the Ari told us. This is now coming true. And we're going to see that Natan of Aza and Shabtai Tzvi himself, both of whom are Kabbalists, they use these ideas to promulgate what they're teaching. Okay. The other picture is, this is beautiful stained glass windows by Mordechai Ardon that are in the National Library. And of course they show the Sfirot and Kabbalah. So that's why I put that there. Okay. Let's talk a little about, the communities where this happens, right? The story happens all over the Ottoman Empire, as we're going to see in a few minutes, but it begins in the land of Israel, okay? A little bit in other places, but it really comes to fruition in the land of Israel. And as we're going to see, that's very important. Where are the places we're talking about in the land of Israel? So by this point, right, by the 1650s, 1660s, Tzfat is less significant. It's still significant, but it's less significant. We're going to be talking about Jerusalem, and we're going to be talking about Aza, which you say, Aza, really? That's a Jewish place? Yes. Okay, we'll get to Aza in a moment. Okay, but first, Jerusalem. So Jerusalem, on hard times, it's not exactly a great and a thriving community, but it's still one of the nicer sized communities in the land of Israel in the 17th century. And one of the things that helps to transform it is you have this chacham, this rabbi called Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz. We're going to talk about him a little later because he's one of the few who stands up to Shabtai Tzvi, right? Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz is born in 1620 in Fez, in Morocco. Eventually he goes to Italy, and he meets this very wealthy family in Livorno. This is a picture of the synagogue in Livorno and Leghorn. He meets this very wealthy family, the Viga family, and he convinces them that what they really want to do with their money is endow a yeshiva in Jerusalem that he is going to be the head of. And they agree. So in 1658, he comes to Jerusalem and he opens what's called the Beit Yaakov. He's Rabbi Yaakov, right? Midrash Beit Yaakov. Now 1650s Jerusalem, what's existing there, right? Mostly a Sephardic community. The Ramban synagogue is no longer being used. This is the Eliyahu HaNavi synagogue. This is one of the four Sephardic synagogues, this complex that the Jews are using. And Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz begins his yeshiva, which is in many ways very revolutionary, right? It has different levels, right? He has beginners, right? Real students, and he has scholars who are there at the same time. He teaches not only Jewish subjects, right? Obviously, Gemara, Mishnah, but also Tanakh. But he also teaches secular subjects, One of the things that he does, which is very interesting, is he doesn't say, well, whoever comes in, we're just going to go straight to Gemara. And this is kind of a very modern approach. He says, we're going to teach the younger people some Tanakh, some Mishnah, some practical halacha, because he knows that a good number of them are going to drop out at a certain point and go to work. So at least they have some grounding. So that I think is an impressive, very modern approach. They also learn math. They also learn Spanish, right? They have different subjects. And another thing that's very important, when the Viga family endows this yeshiva, it's not just the yeshiva, it's to give a stipend to anyone who studies there. So that's very important for the economic well-being of scholars in Jerusalem. Now, he has many students who are attracted to this yeshiva. It strengthens the Jewish community in Jerusalem. And he has some very famous people, Rabbi Chezkiah da Silva, Rabbi Moshe Chabib, Rabbi Yaakov Mocho, and a very young Nathan Ashkenazi, Natan of Aza, studies with Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz. They're gonna become combatants and opponents, but he begins by studying. He's born in Jerusalem. He studies in this yeshiva. He's a very brilliant student. But we're gonna come back to him a little bit later. Okay. In Aza, which is where Natan moves to, he gets married and he marries the daughter of a merchant and he moves to Aza. Aza is a community of merchants. Okay. And that's where Shabtai Tzvi is proclaimed the Messiah by Natan. Okay. It was a Jewish community in ancient times. We have a very beautiful and ornate synagogue mosaic from there, from Byzantine times. It's depicting King David playing his lyre, right? It's got a lot of other animals. Very interesting mosaic. You can see it in the Good Samaritan Museum the next time you come to Israel. But it's a community that has, it's smaller than Jerusalem, but it still has a few hundred people. Most of them are traders. This is a picture of the old town of Gaza from the 19th century. I did not find any good pictures of Gaza from the 17th century. Sorry, so we'll have to make do with this. Hey, it also has a community that has Shomronim. I'll just address one question that I noticed from Batya. She says, "Why isn't Tanakh a Jewish subject?" I didn't say Tanakh is not a Jewish subject. It's not. It was not a subject that was necessarily traditionally studied in higher level yeshivot, right? That was much more Mishnah and Gemara. Tanakh is kind of, Tanakh, even today in the real Haredi yeshivas, what do you know from Tanakh? You know, whatever the Gemara quotes, right? But to study Tanakh as a subject, that was rather unusual.
High school in Israel, even the yeshiva high school in Israel, Tanakh is in the afternoon along with math.
Correct, correct. It's considered something that's secondary. Okay. Although that's evolving. Thank goodness. Okay. So now after that lengthy introduction, let's talk a little about Shabtai Tzvi. Okay. So Shabtai Tzvi is born in the city of Izmir or Smyrna, however you want to call it, in 1626 on Tisha B'Av, right? Now there were those who said, well, really? He's not born on Tisha B'Av. Why? Because that's a classic thing that his followers would say, because who's born on Tisha B'Av? The Mashiach. So of course, Shabtai Tzvi is born on Tisha B'Av, but it seems it's actually true because we know his birth date is correct, 1626. And his name is Shabtai, which is an unusual name. We're going to talk about Saturn in a minute, but Shabtai was a name that was sometimes given to boys who were born on Shabbat, right? And if you look at the calendar, Tisha B'Av in 1626 was Shabbat. So that's just an interesting thing. He's born into a probably Ashkenazic family, merchants. His brothers become very wealthy. He is the smart one in the family and he's sent off to study, right? And he's very learned, but he's kind of strange, right? He's kind of a strange guy. He has trouble with intimacy. He actually has two different marriages, neither of which he consummates, right? He gets married and the brides come and say, nothing's happening here. And that annuls the marriage. And that happens twice. He's very learned. He's very smart. He likes to be off by himself. He studies Kabbalah. And probably the most interesting thing about his character is that he has what we would call today a bipolar personality or a manic depressive personality. Now, we don't know this 100%. It's very iffy, giving psychological diagnoses to people in the past. But he describes, and other people describe him as having these periods of highs and lows, right? And he calls them illuminations. That's the high, right? When he's filled with this divine light. And the other side is the hiding of the face, hester panim, when God is hiding from him. Okay, so he has these high moments, he has these low moments. In his high moments, he does what are called ma'asim zarim, strange things. Most of these strange things are antinomian, are against the Torah, not for fun, but because he believes that this is the way you're supposed to act, right? So we're going to come back to that. But this idea of highs and lows of maybe two parts of his personality, okay, the Kabbalist Natan of Aza explains that this is because when he's in his lows, he's descended into the depths to redeem the sparks of light that have fallen down, right? It's a very nice Kabbalistic explanation for a psychological issue. Now, one of the later scholars of mysticism, right, a student of Gershom Scholem, who's come up with different ideas from him, Professor Moshe Idel, he says, we have to look a little bit outside. Don't be so internally Jewish. We have to look at outside influences as well, right? And he says, let's look also at astrology, right? So Shabtai Tzvi, and we'll come back to this a little bit later, right? Shabtai Tzvi is supposed to be born under the sign of Saturn. What does that mean? Saturn, Shabtai, is supposed to be connected to the Jews. Christian astrologers also believe that when Saturn and Jupiter converge, that's when you'll have new religions, new messiahs, right? Saturn, and this is how we use the word today, Saturnine, right, is somebody who has a character that's somewhat melancholy, right? So all of these ideas kind of fit together very nicely with Shabtai Tzvi's personality, with what we know about him. So he's this kind of a strange fellow who's more or less tolerated in the community because he happens to be very learned, because he's not causing any harm to anybody. It doesn't hurt that he's a nice looking guy, right? And this we think is what he looks like, although we don't really know, right? But these are portraits from around the time that he lives, right? These are at the time, not like you have pictures of Rashi that were made in the 1900s, right? These are pictures from the 1660s. So he's more or less tolerated because he's a pleasant enough fellow. He has a beautiful voice, right? People talk about his singing and his praying, and he doesn't cause too much trouble to anybody. But then his life kind of changes as he starts to talk about the fact that A, he is going to go against certain laws because he believes that that's the right thing to do at this time. Okay. And we're going to see that becomes very extreme. He pronounces God's name, right? The four letters, Shem Hashem, the Yud Kei Vav Kei, he goes around pronouncing it, which is not something that you are supposed to do. And at a certain point, he starts to claim that he is the Messiah. So he has a very peripatetic life, and we're going to draw a little where he goes, right? So he starts out here in Izmir, in this port city. He's going to come back there a little later in his life, okay? By the 1650s, the rabbis of Izmir have kind of had enough of him. He's just too strange. He's talking about being the Messiah. We're not interested. And they banish him. This is going to be a pattern that we're going to keep following. They banish him from Izmir. So where does he go? He goes to another very important Jewish community, Salonika. And he goes to Salonika. And there he does okay until 1658, when he gets banished from there because he does a ceremony where he is the Chatan Torah. He has a chuppah and a sefer Torah, and he marries the Torah. And the rabbis of Salonika, they don't like that so much. Goodbye, Shabtai Tzvi. Move on. So where does he go next? He goes to Istanbul, right? He's hitting all the hot spots of the Ottoman Empire. He goes to Istanbul, and there he gets in trouble in 1662 for doing a number of things. First of all, he celebrates all of the Shalosh Regalim, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. He celebrates them all in 1 week, okay? That's not exactly following Jewish law. He goes around pronouncing Shem Hashem, like we said. He abolishes mitzvot, okay? And he actually makes a bracha on abolishing these mitzvot. What does he say, right? We have a bracha that we say in our Birkot HaShachar and our morning blessings, Hamatir Asurim, right? God who frees the imprisoned. He changes it to Hametir Isurim, God who permits the forbidden, right? And he does all of these antinomian things. So he gets kicked out of Istanbul. He comes back to Izmir, and then he goes to Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem is a place that from time immemorial has had all kinds of strange characters roaming around, and he is one of them. And And so he's also kind of tolerated. He knows a lot of Torah. He knows a lot of Kabbalah. He mostly keeps to himself. And he actually becomes accepted enough, or they're desperate enough, that in 1663, a year after he arrives, he's sent to Cairo as the emissary of the Jewish community of Jerusalem to raise money. Okay, now he stays in Cairo for 2 years, where he continues with his very strange acts, and he marries for a third time, only this time it's a real marriage. He marries this kind of a mysterious figure. Her name is Sarah. She claims that she is an orphan. Her parents were killed in the Khmelnytsky massacres. There are all kinds of rumors about her, that she's a woman of easy virtue. Perhaps that's why he marries her, right? He sees himself as like Hosea the prophet who marries a prostitute, right? Whatever it is. And he continues with these ups and downs. And in 1665, he decides he needs to do something about this, and he heads to Aza, which is not on my map, but it's over here. So if we wanted to draw a little, you know, map of Shabtai Tzvi, he goes here, he goes here, he goes here, Jerusalem, Cairo, Aza, and eventually he's going to head back to Izmir, and that's where things are really going to come to a head. Okay, so that's our Shabtai Tzvi, our little map of where he goes. What happens? Okay, this is where we're going to encounter our second figure. Okay, Nathan of Gaza, Natan HaAzati. Now, like we said, he's quite a bit younger than Shabtai Tzvi. He's almost 20 years younger. He has a reputation as a brilliant scholar. He is one of Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz's students. He moves to Aza, and he starts to study Kabbalah, and he starts to believe a few different things. Number one, he believes that he has a power that Rav Yitzchak Luria, that the Ari said he had, which is to fix souls. He can look at somebody and he can read the inner essence of their soul and tell them what they need to do to achieve a pure tikkun, to make the soul be perfect and achieve its purpose. This is why Shabtai Tzvi comes to him, right? He hears about this, right? I was listening to a lecture about Shabtai Tzvi where the lecturer called him a psychologist, a terrible psychologist, because he tells Shabtai Tzvi exactly the wrong thing, right? But Shabtai Tzvi comes in, maybe you can help me. What is the root of my soul? What am I supposed to do, right? The other thing he believes, Natan, when he starts to study Kabbalah, this is what we have in the quote here, he believes that he has been revealed to him who is the Mashiach, right? And this is what he writes about. When I had attained the age of 20, I began to study the Zohar and the Lurianic writings. Whoever wants to purify himself receives the aids of heaven. And he sent me some of his holy angels and blessed spirits who revealed many mysteries of the Torah to me. That same year, energized by the visions of the angels and the blessed souls, I was engaged in a prolonged fast during the week before the Feast of Purim. I locked myself in a room in holiness and purity, and I tearfully recited the penitential prayers of the morning service. And the spirit came over me. My hair stood on end. My knees shook. I beheld the Merkava, right? God's chariot. I saw visions of God all day long and all night. I was vouchsafed true prophecy. With utmost clarity, my heart perceived toward whom my prophecy was directed. And only then did the angel permit me to proclaim what I had seen. I recognized that he was the true Messiah, right? He had met Shabtai Tzvi in Jerusalem. And when Shabtai Tzvi shows up, he realizes that this prophecy is real. Now, a lot of these things that we are going to talk about, you could read them very cynically, right? And you could say Shabtai Tzvi and Natan of Aza understand this is a great way to become famous, to make money. I think that's kind of cheapening it. I really do think that they believed very profoundly in what they're saying. They're mistaken, but they believe it very profoundly. And Shabtai Tzvi comes to Natan and he says, you know, tell me the root of my soul. And Natan says to him, you're the Mashiach. And Shabtai Tzvi says, really? No, I don't think so. And Natan reads him a prediction from somebody who he says is a 12th century German rabbi, Rabbi Avraham HaChassid. We now know that he wrote this prediction, right? Saying that this is clearly about you, Shabtai Tzvi, right? And Natan, even though he's much younger than Shabtai Tzvi, is a very brilliant scholar. He's very respected. And this is another one of these great paintings, woodcuts, I think, from the 17th century, where here's Natan, right? Natan, not Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi is the one on the horse. Here's Natan leading the tribes of Israel to the Holy Land, right? So he is trying to convince Shabtai Tzvi, and he sends out a message to the Jewish world. The redemption is coming and you have to do penitence. More on that in a moment. Okay. But meanwhile, Shabtai Tzvi is not completely convinced. So he takes him on a journey. He takes him to Jerusalem. He takes him to Hebron, right? To Marat HaMachpelah. He tries to convince him that this is it. And finally, Shabtai Tzvi is convinced. They come back to Aza, and on Shavuot, Natan proclaims to everyone around that Shabtai Tzvi is the Mashiach, right? We are now in 1665, right? May, June, 1665. And here he is. He's the Mashiach. And Shabtai Tzvi is, you know, very overcome. Clearly, he's in one of his high periods. And he starts to appoint for his followers. He says, you're the representative of Judah. You're the representative of Benjamin, right? All the different 12 tribes. And he starts giving out kingdoms. You get the kingdom of France and you get the Ottoman Empire, all of this stuff. Meanwhile, this has not spread yet to the Jewish world. It's very, very contained in Gaza. But they start to travel around the land of Israel. And the news starts to spread and it starts to become very popular. And they come to Jerusalem. And Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz is not pleased. Right. And he knows Natan. He knows Shabtai Tzvi. This is no Mashiach. And the things he's doing are completely forbidden. And he continues doing them in Jerusalem, by the way. One of the things he does, which is a fascinating thing, and all the accounts talk about this, the Jewish accounts, he has his followers eat chalev. Right. What's chalev? Chalev is forbidden fat. It's really not a big thrill because you can eat permitted fat. The forbidden fat, it's not like you're going to eat a cheeseburger. It probably tastes the same as the permitted fat. Why are you doing it? Because it is not allowed. And we are in a world now where everything is turned upside down, where we have to descend into the world of sin, right? What's called Yirida Litzorech Aliyah, taking a phrase from the Talmud. We have to go down in order to come up. And Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz understands this for what it is. This is antinomian. This is going against the Torah. And he and other important rabbis in Jerusalem, Rabbi Yaakov Tzemach as well, they put Shabtai Tzvi and Natan of Gaza in Chayrem. They excommunicate them. Now, I think it's fascinating that in Jerusalem, which is supposed to be the epicenter of the redemption, right? Last time we saw this as well, they are more reluctant to accept these redeemers. You think you're the redeemer? Not really, right? So they put him in Chayrem. They send a letter to Istanbul to the rabbis there, but then they don't do anything more, which is interesting. Like, are they hedging their bets? Do they want to wait and see what happens? We don't know. But that's the last we hear from the rabbis of Jerusalem. Okay, the picture here, this is a book that was written by Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz, Hilchot Ktanot. One of the things he did in his yeshiva, which is very interesting, is that every Friday he would have a session of what we call She'elot U'Tshuvot, right? Responsa. People would come to Jerusalem and they would come to the Beit Midrash and they would ask their halachic questions and the students would debate and then they would come up with an answer and it was published in this book. So I brought that because I don't have a picture of Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz. The other picture here is of the Kabbalistic yeshiva in Jerusalem, the Beit El yeshiva with the beautiful door. It's actually an anachronistic picture. The Kabbalistic yeshiva is not till the 1700s. But okay, that was the picture I brought. Okay, so Natan continues, right? He goes to Tzfat, then he goes to Aleppo, and then he continues back to Izmir, okay? And once he gets to Izmir, right, it's a port. Remember, it's on the port there. There are Dutch traders and English and German, and they hear about this, non-Jews mostly, Jews as well, but a lot of non-Jews, and they're flabbergasted, and they start to send word back to their various countries, and stories start to spread, both among the Jews and the Christians, right? That's a fascinating thing. And these stories are wild, right? Ships that have been seen that have the banners of the 10 lost tribes on them because the 10 lost tribes are going to come back. And all the miracles that Shabtai Tzvi and Natan HaAzati do and all of these crazy, fantastic stories, which are in a way true, right? But they spread like wildfire throughout the world. Meanwhile, Shabtai Tzvi, without Natan stays in the land of Israel, right? He comes back to Izmir. He has some opponents there. And on Hanukkah 16, we're still in 1665, the people in the Portuguese synagogue, and this is one of the synagogues of Izmir. It's not the Portuguese one, but it's an old synagogue in Izmir. And the people in the Portuguese synagogue are opposed to him. So on Shabbat, Hanukkah, right, coming up, he actually goes with his followers. The doors to the synagogue are locked against him. He takes an axe and he starts to smash the doors, breaks into the shul, kind of takes over the Torah service. He insists on reading the Torah from a printed chumash, right? Not from a Sefer Torah. Printed chumash is relatively new, right? We're only in the 1600s. But maybe to say that, you know, this is the new way of doing things. And then then he starts to call people up for aliyot. Disregarding Cohen, Levi, he doesn't care about that. He calls up whoever he wants. He calls up women as well as men, right? Very interesting, the role of women in this whole story. He promises them all kinds of, again, kingdoms. He makes them pronounce God's name, right? He makes them say the Shem HaMeforash, right? And then he says, he announces that he is the Messiah. The redemption is going to be in Sivan, i.e. in another 6 months, okay? And then he, very oddly, okay, sings a Spanish love song, which he interprets as a song of love between God and the people of Israel, okay? He dismisses the chief rabbi of Izmir, who's not his supporter. He puts another rabbi in place, Rabbi Chaim ben Benisti. People start saying prayers, right? The prayer for Tfilah l'shlom ha-medina, l'shlom ha-malchut, right? The prayers that Jews say all over the diaspora for the king or the duke or whoever. They start to say it for the Mashiach Shabtai Tzvi, right? And he starts to get a title, right? And by this point, things have gotten out of control. So his title is Amirah, right? It's an acronym. Adonenu, Morenu, Malkenu, Yarum Hodo. Our master, our teacher, our king, whose importance or whose grace should be lifted up. And he starts to sign his name as not just the Messiah, right? Take a look. The first begotten and only Son of God. Okay. He even has letters where he writes that he is God. Okay. It really is getting out of control. Okay. And he is completely proclaimed, as the Messiah. And like I said, the news spreads like wildfire throughout the Jewish world. Okay. And remember, we're already in the time of the printing press. Okay. Books are printed for the masses on how they should do penance, because that's a very important part of the story. Christians write about this. Jews write about this. We have pictures. So here's a great picture from Amsterdam from 1666. Ateret Tzvi, right? The crown of Tzvi. And here he is sitting on his throne. And this is the tikkun, and this is how you can prepare yourself for the coming of the Messiah. And we have different reports from different people. So one of them, here's a Christian report. This is one that was very well known. This is a guy named Sir Paul Reichart. He's the English ambassador to the Ottoman court. And he writes about this, and he tells us, now all the cities of Turkey were full of the expectation of the Messiah. No trade or courses of gain were followed, right? What do people do? Mashiach's coming. I don't need to go to work anymore. And even more than that, I'm going to sell off everything I have, as we're going to see in a second, in the other account, because I need to, you know, get myself to the land of Israel. Everyone imagined that daily provisions, riches, honor, and government were to descend upon him by some unknown and miraculous manner. Then he goes on to talk about these ideas of penance. Right? Everybody believes that in order to be redeemed, you have to do tshuva. Some applied themselves immediately to fasting. Others buried themselves in their gardens. Others would endure to have melted wax dropped on their shoulders. Others to roll themselves in snow. But the most common method of mortification was first to prick their backs and sides with thorns and then give themselves 39 lashes. So you have on the one hand this kind of very feverish expectation and excitement. You even have processions through the streets, and there's a lot of Jewish pride. On the other hand, there's this idea that we have to do penance because otherwise we're not going to be worthy, right? Now, another fascinating account that we have is what we have over here. This is from a woman named Gluckel of Hamelin. Gluckel of Hamelin is a very interesting Jewish woman who her husband was a merchant, and she actually keeps a diary, right? It's not a history and it's not a religious book. It's actually a diary of her life, and it's one of the few times that we have a woman who tells us about her everyday life. And of course, she is part of this story as well, right? And she talks about the letters coming, right? People are hearing about this in real time. Our joy when the letters arrive from Smyrna is not to be told. Most were addressed to the Spartan, right? Because they have connections to the people there, who as fast as they came, took them to their synagogue and read them aloud. Young and old, the Germans too hastened to the Spartic synagogue. The Spartic youth came dressed in their best finery, decked in broad green silk ribbons, the gear of Shabtai Tzvi. With timbrels and dancers, they one and all trooped to the synagogue. They read the letters with joy, like the joy of the feast of water drying, right? Simchat Beit HaShoeivah. And then listen to what they do. Many sold their houses and lands and all their possessions for any day they hoped to be redeemed. And Gluckel's not just telling about this from hearsay. She has it in real life. My good father-in-law left his home in Hamelin, abandoned his house and lands and all his goodly furniture, and moved to Hildesheim. He sent to us in Hamburg two enormous casks packed with linen, and peas, beans, dried meat, shredded prunes, and the like, every manner of food that would keep for the old man expected at any moment to sail from Hamburg to the Holy Land, right? We even hear about people who climb up on their roofs waiting for the eagles to come and to deliver them to Eretz Yisrael. So it's reaching this very, very feverish pitch. And then Shabtai Tzvi makes a fatal mistake, although it might have happened anyway. He gets on a boat to come from Izmir to Istanbul because he has to go tell the Sultan that he's here, right? The Messiah is here. The Sultan hears about all this. Doesn't sound so good to him. He has Shabtai Tzvi arrested already at sea, but unlike other traitors to the empire who are immediately executed, Shabtai Tzvi is put in prison, right? These are some nice pictures of Istanbul, of the Hagia Sophia Mosque. Now you have the port. Shabtai Tzvi is not executed. He's put in prison. And that gives people hope, right? Because they say, wow, he's not executed because clearly the Sultan understands that there's something very special, right? He's imprisoned in Gallipoli, right, on this peninsula. But he's given some very good conditions and his followers are allowed to come. And they actually call his fortress the Migdal Oz, right? And the prison is comfortable. And he continues his antinomian behavior in prison. So before Pesach, he manages to get a little lamb and he makes a Passover sacrifice, right? He celebrates the ninth of Av, right? He doesn't fast. He abolishes the fast and he celebrates the ninth of Av as his birthday, right? And then what happened? He gets a visit from another Kabbalistic messianic hopeful from Poland, whose name is Nehemiah HaKohen. Just recently, there was an Israeli fictional book written about him. And he comes to see him in the prison and he says, Shabtai Tzvi, you got it all wrong. You're not the true Messiah. For you might be the Mashiach ben David, but the Mashiach ben Yosef has to come first. And I am a messianic figure. And they have an altercation, the details of which are not super important to us, but they have an altercation. Ultimately, Nehemiah decides to convert to Islam. And he turns in Shabtai Tzvi. He goes to the Sultan. He goes to Adrianople. He tells the Sultan that this guy is, you know, should be brought before him for sedition, okay, as a traitor. He's brought before the Sultan in Adrianople, and he's given a very stark choice, which is convert to Islam or have your head chopped off. And Shabtai Tzvi chooses. And he chooses to convert. Okay? He chooses to convert. He gets an Islamic name, okay? Aziz Mehmed Effendi. He gets some privileges. He has about 200 followers who convert as well. He seems to follow some Jewish practices while he is still a Muslim, but he lives out the rest of his life as a Muslim. What happens next, right? What is the result in the Jewish world? So as Gershon Shalom says, I'll quote from him because he says it so beautifully, the paradox of a traitorous Messiah is far greater than that of an executed Messiah, right? Of course, referring to Jesus. When Jesus is executed, followers don't have trouble believing in him still as the Messiah. He might not be alive anymore, but he didn't betray them. Shabtai Tzvi betrays his followers, okay? What do we do with that? So there are differences in different approaches, right? So here's our Sir Paul Reichard again. The news of Shabtai turning Turk quickly filled all parts of Turkey. The Jews were strangely surprised and ashamed of their easiness of belief. Abroad, they became the common derision of the towns where they inhabited. Right here, we had all this Jewish pride, and suddenly it's not happening, and people are making fun of Jews. But yet, most of them affirm that Shabtai is not turned Turk, but his shadow only remains on earth and walks with a white head and in the habit of a Mohammedan, but that his body and soul are taken to heaven, there to reside until the time appointed for accomplishment of these wonders. If reality doesn't conform to your beliefs, you really have to change reality, right? And that's what a lot of people do, right? Natan explains it as he needs to become a Muslim because the greatest depths, the deepest places of the sparks that are caught in the klipot are in Islam. And he has to dive down into them. He has to be the spy in the enemy camp, right? Others believe that, like it says here, right? He is ascended to heaven. He's going to come back. Others go along with him. Okay. And there's a whole sect in Turkey up until modern times called the Donme. This is one of their mosques in Salonika, who are Muslims, but they're also Jews and they're also believers in Shabtai Tzvi. And others are very, very disillusioned, right? And they throw this all away. There's a strain of secret underground Sabbateanism because the rabbis are very against this. But a lot of people are just very, very disappointed. And the story is kind of hushed up, right? We don't want to talk about this story because this is a really embarrassing and upsetting story. But let's go back a step for a minute. Why does it work, right? So this is just to reiterate a little bit of Gershon Scholem's ideas. One is that despite the denouement of the story happening in Turkey, it comes out of the land of Israel, okay? Natan, Shabtai, they're from the land of Israel. The news is promulgated at first in the land of Israel. And of course, the redemption, the Messiah has to come from Israel. If he starts out in Izmir, that's less convincing, right? So that's an important idea. And the other is because of these Kabbalistic ideas that are out there, and they are just kind of, everyone says, oh, of course this came true, right? And like I said, Moshe Edel says you have to look at other things, sociological, astrology, the impact of the Muranos, right? But you can have many different reasons, but it's an unprecedented phenomenon. And it continues underground. And will this will end? Okay. You have secret Sabbateans who continue even after Shabtai Tzvi dies, right? 1676, Shabtai Tzvi dies in exile in the Balkans. 1680, Natan HaAzati dies. He's also not in the land of Israel anymore. He's in Macedonia, but there are still believers and they have to go underground because they're really an object of derision in the Jewish world. And there is one group, which pretty much everyone agrees by now that they are secret Sabbateans, even though there was debate about it earlier. But this is a guy from Poland named Rabbi Judah the Hasid, not to be confused with the Rabbi Judah the Hasid from Germany from the 12th century. This is Rabbi Judah the Hasid from the 18th century. He has a large group of followers. They believe the redemption is on the way, right? He doesn't say outright that he's a Sabbatean. It's kind of coded and secret. They make their way to the land of Israel. They make their way to Jerusalem. They buy a piece of property. They build a small synagogue, okay? And then it does not go well. Rabbi Yehuda Hasid gets the plague. He dies very soon afterwards. His followers can't make a go of it. They can't pay back the money that they borrowed in order to buy the land to build the synagogue. And eventually, 1721, they're kicked out of Jerusalem and their synagogue is destroyed. And it gets a name that means destruction, and that's the Horva. Okay. And for the next more than 100 years, Ashkenazi Jews do not come back to Jerusalem because they think and they know and they're correct that if they come back, the Arabs who had lent the money to Rabbi Yehuda Hasid and his followers will say, well, you're Ashkenazi like them, pay back the money. Now, why did I bring you this Hasid over here? He is wearing what's called the garb of the Yerushalmi Hasidim. And the Yerushalmi Hasidim wear striped coats, black and white during the week, gold and white on Shabbat. It's very distinctive. You don't see it in other places in the world. Why do they wear this? Because this is what the Sephardim wore in the 18th and the 19th century. And if you wanted to come to Jerusalem as an Ashkenazi, you had to disguise yourself and pretend to be a Sephardi. And that's why this clothing became popular, right? And there are only Sephardim in Jerusalem. This is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai shul. No Ashkenazim until we have the Aliyah of the students of the Vilna Gaon. Okay, students of the Vilna Gaon first come to Tzfat. This is the beginning of the 19th century, 1808, 1809. And eventually they decide they're going to come to Jerusalem. They settle the debt, right? This is what we think is the Vilna Gaon, although he also probably didn't look like this. This is from the Gra Synagogue in Shari Chesed, founded by the descendants of the students of the Vilna Gaon. And this is the sundial that's there. They come, they pay off the debt, they get permission from the Turks, and they rebuild the Horva. And the guiding spirit behind this is one of these students whose name Rav Shlomo Zalman Soreif. And if you look at his gravestone, his monument, which was destroyed for many years by the Jordanians and has just been fixed up. Hasher Hitzil Nachlat HaAshkenazim Meyad Hisham HaYishmaeli, right? He saved the area of the Ashkenazim from the Arabs, the Ishmaelites. The Ishtadel B'Bniyahu B'Prat Binyan HaBeit HaMidrash HaNikra B'Shem Menachem Tzion, right? That's the Beit Midrash connected to the Chorva. And then you see HaRashaz of Shlomo Zalman Tzoref, Bonei Yerushalayim HaChadasha, the builder of the New Jerusalem, V'Goel HaChorva, and the redeemer of the Chorva. And he's buried here in Nachal Kidron. His grave was just found recently. And it's just a fascinating kind of end to the story of the Ashkenazi Jews who come back to Jerusalem, who rebuild this shul built by a Sabbatian. They are very not Sabbatians, but they are very much kind of harbingers of a more modern Jerusalem. The students of the Gra are kind of the beginning of the new buildings of Jerusalem. And the story of Shabtai Tzvi, does it have lessons to teach us? Maybe, right? Something breaks in the Jewish world with the story of Shabtai Tzvi. Gershon Shalom saw it as the precursor to the Hasidut movement, right? Hasidism comes out of Lurianic Kabbalah, but also as a response to Shabtai Tzvi. Maybe it's some kind of a precursor to modernity. It definitely leads to skepticism about messiahs, right? There's something broken in the Jewish world after Shabtai Tzvi that never really goes back. And it's a fascinating and not well enough known story. Okay, I'm going to take a look at questions, but before I do that, just two announcements. First of all, this is the end of the series. I'm going to do something different, probably Tanakh, although anyone who wants to send suggestions, I'm happy to hear. And number two, very exciting, we are hoping to do a live, real, in-person trip to Israel with Torah in Motion, Be'ezrat Hashem, in February, and I'm going to guide it, and I would love to see you all there. We need a lot of buses for 125 people, but you are all very welcome. There will be details soon. Let me see questions meanwhile. Okay. Gershon Shalom's home office was preserved in the National Library. Yes, it's still there. All right. And his collection of books, which is even more important. I'm not diagnosing anybody. I don't think autistic. I think bipolar makes more sense. And I'm not going to even venture to deal with his sexual identity. Sorry, this is not me. Izmir is known for dried fruits. Right. Sounds a little like some people relate to the Rebbe, right? And there are people who, when the Lubavitcher Rebbe died, saw this as almost like a Shabtai Tzvi moment, which thank God did not happen, right? And the Rebbe's Torah was very real, was very true, and the movement that he started did not crash and burn. I'm not saying Christians accepted him. I'm saying Christians were also amazed by this story. I don't think that the Christians accept him as a Messiah. What traditions do the followers follow? Thank Jewish you. Muslim, reverse Jewish law? I don't know so much about the Donmeh, but I believe that they are outwardly Muslim with some secret Jewish traditions. Interestingly, I just read about this today. They become part of the Young Turk movement, right? The revolution in when the Ottoman Empire is over. It's just interesting. The Sephardim didn't wear hats like a Hasid, right? Now, this is just a Hasid from today. It's not a guy from a picture from the 17th century, 18th century. My daughter is getting married in Tzfat on Monday. Beautiful. Mazal Tov. Who is that? Irene. Mazal Tov, Irene. The Val Madonna collection has a big poster about Shabtai Tzvi telling people to wait at the coast. Yeah, there are these pictures everywhere, right? Google it. You'll see unbelievable things of these pictures. Some are real. Probably most are fake, but they're fascinating because they tell you what people are thinking about this whole story. Other questions? Other comments? We good? All right. Hanukkah Sameach, everybody.
Shuli.
Yes.
I would like, first of all, it was excellent, but I'd like to know if a person's in Israel in February, can they hook up on that program you're doing or not?
So Rabbi Kelman is ironing out the details, but yes, that is going to be the idea, that you can join even if you are not traveling from abroad.
Really?
But there will be more details. Okay, I don't know about the headgear. I'm sorry. The Strymels come from Poland, so that's a good question. I don't have it. I don't have an answer yet. Dates in February, I think we had talked about the 15th to the 22nd, but it's all still very open. So stay tuned to this channel. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Maxine.
Also, thank you. Thank you. Excellent.
Dr. Shoa made the cataloging system in the library years ago, the Jewish Judaica. The whole cataloging system at the Hebrew University Library.
Correct. Was from him. He's the one who came up with it. Thank you.
Right. Yeah.
That's another interesting detail. He was fascinating. I very much recommend his book. He also was one of the first. He writes about how when Hitler comes to power, he is the first person who shows up at the whatever the German embassy to hand in his citizenship, to renounce his citizenship. Right. He's just a very, very interesting person all around. But thank you for that detail.
Yeah, I just want to say that I just read that a professor from Johns Hopkins was denied opening the archive of Spinoza.
Okay.
So it's interesting because he's in Tehran. And the Spanish Portuguese rabbi in Amsterdam.
Wait, you muted yourself, Fran. We're not hearing the end of your story. Unmute.
A professor of Johns Hopkins, wanted to study the works of Spinoza,
right?
As a professor, and the rabbi of the Spanish Portuguese synagogue not only denied it because Spinoza was in Cheyrem, but he sent a terrible letter to him saying that he is. I actually have a copy of the letter saying that. He is, you devoted your life to the study of Spinoza's banned works and the development of ideas. Your request to visit our complex and create a film about this Apicores heretic in our synagogue is incompatible with our centuries-old halachic, historic, and ethical tradition. An unacceptable assault on our identity and heritage.
Why?
I therefore deny your request and declare you a persona non grata in the Portuguese synagogue complex. And then he ends, I wish you a meaningful Hanukkah.
All right, so you're saying these wounds run very deep.
Right,
they do not disappear.
Right.
So wow. Somebody just sent the letter. Oh, thank you. That's so interesting.
This was actually in the Jewish Review of Books.
Someone just sent in the chat a link to the letter.
Yeah. Oh,
thank
good.
You.
Good.
So interesting. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Great.
All right, everybody. Hanukkah Sameach. Thank you so
Hanukkah
much.
Hanukkah Sameach.
Hanukkah Sameach.
Hanukkah Sameach.
So much. Wonderful as always.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Hanukkah Sameach.
Hanukkah Sameach.